ACMA, that won't happen.
They will not have the administrative capacity and the political credibility to successfully introduce a new currency.
When countries try to introduce new currencies in bad times, it can end in complete economic collapse. In other words, Kierkegaard says, Greece could wind up with a failed, worthless drachma and be locked out of the eurozone.
It is the worst of all worlds, unfortunately.
So when Greek citizens step into the voting booth on Sunday, those will be their options. A yes vote.
The death spiral.
Or a no vote.
The worst of all worlds.
I called a few people in Greece this week to see what they thought about all this. They said that for them, the vote is about more than economics. Dimitrios Tsiranis, the engineer in Athens, said he's voting on where Greece sits in the world.
I don't see any future for the country outside Europe. We live in a dangerous neighborhood.
So does that mean that to you, voting no in the referendum is like voting no to Europe?
Yes, absolutely. I believe that.
Several people I spoke with this week agreed. They felt like they were voting on Greece's future inside or outside of Europe. Serrani said he plans to vote yes in the referendum. The others I spoke with said they weren't sure how they'd vote. Jacob Goldstein, NPR News.
Many Greeks will tell you they are proudly European, but how that will translate into votes in Sunday's referendum is not simple. Reporter Joanna Kakissis spoke with two Greek voters who have very different ideas about what it means to be European.
Elisabeth Zachariadou is a retired professor of history. She admires Italian art, reads French literature and German philosophy. She considers herself a European.
When I learned that Greece is going to be part of the European Union, I was very happy. And I said, how nice and how good for all of us.
But Zachariadou's attachment to Europe is complex. She's 84 and lives in the Athens suburb where she grew up during World War II, when Nazi Germany invaded Greece and her people suffered horribly.
It was not strange to open this door and find a person dead in the street because of starvation.
European meddling is part of modern Greek history. Zachariadou brings up Clemens von Metternich, a German prince who served as foreign minister in the Austrian Empire. Metternich opposed the creation of a modern Greek state from the remains of the Ottoman Empire in the 1820s.
I am surprised to see in Germany a tendency in the spirit of Metternich today, that we are just troublemakers.
In short, Zachariadou doesn't trust German or other European leaders. And that's why she's voting no in Sunday's referendum. She says they don't have Greeks' best interests at heart. But in an upscale cafe in another Athens suburb, we meet Yorgos Papadopoulos, who runs his family's kitchen furniture business. He says Greeks owe Europeans a lot.
We've got access to one of the largest markets on the planet. We can travel wherever we want. We have a one currency.
Papadopoulos is only 37. He grew up in a democratic Greece, which followed the six-year military dictatorship supported by the United States. He knows from history books that foreign influence has often been bad. But he's tired of hearing conspiracy theories that foreign powers are intent on destroying the Greek economy.
People say they're going to bankrupt Greece so they can buy it cheaper. And they're going to buy cheaper what? The sun? The beaches? These are not things they're going to take away from us. They will always be here.
Papadopoulos remembers the fights over whether Greece should join the European Union in 1981. Socialists said Greece belongs to the Greeks. Conservatives said Greece belongs to the West. He agrees and says Greece will be exposed and isolated if it leaves the eurozone.
This is the biggest union of countries on the history of this planet, but everybody joined in willingly. Still, countries want to join in. You don't feel narrowed down to your own country's borders. I feel a lot stronger when I'm in the European Union, as an individual and as a country.
He's going to vote yes on the referendum. He says it's a vote for Europe and its common currency, the euro. But Elisabeth Zachariadou, the professor, says she does not need the euro to feel European.
What they try to tell us is that Europe is something superficial. Europe is a coin. And this I don't want to accept this.
For her, Europe should be united by more than just money. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
Support for Planet Money comes from Athena Health, cloud-based EHR and practice management services for medical groups and health systems to help physicians work as one across the continuum of care. More at athenahealth.com.
And we're covering everything this morning, including woolly mammoths who roamed the frozen tundra over 12,000 years ago during the last ice age. Their closest relative alive these days is the Asian elephant, which lives in warm tropical forests. NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports that scientists have now compared the DNA of these two mighty beasts to try and figure out how woolly mammoths got to be so, well, woolly.
The woolly mammoth had long, shaggy fur, a small tail and ears to minimize frostbite, and a lot of fat to help stay warm.
And they have this weird hump on their back, which is thought to be something like a camel hump, sort of a fat deposit that stored water and energy for the cold, dark winters.
Vincent Lynch is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Chicago.
We wanted to identify the genetic changes that happened in woolly mammoths that make them mammoth-like.
Mammoths are extinct, but thawing ice means bits of them turn up from time to time. You can even buy mammoth hair on eBay. These researchers did. Then they extracted the DNA. In the journal Cell Reports, they describe how they compared it to the DNA of Asian elephants. They found a long list of genes with mammoth-specific changes. But Lynch says, here's the trouble.
We know that most genetic differences between species actually are neutral. They have no function.
Still, they spotted one gene that seemed intriguing.
Based on what we know in humans and mice, it had three functions. It functions in sensing the external temperature. It functions in fat biology, and it functions in regulating hair growth.
Lynch says previous studies have shown that if you disable this gene in mice,
they actually prefer to live in colder environments.
The scientists wanted to see if the mammoth-specific change in this gene would alter the protein it makes and have a similar effect. And some lab experiments suggested maybe so.
We found that the mammoth protein was much less active. It's sort of like if you had a dimmer switch and a light. That was kind of like turning down the activity of the protein.
But Lynch says, don't think you can take this information and use it to transform an Asian elephant into a mammoth.
You could change this one gene in an elephant and maybe make it woolly mammoth-like with respect to some things.
Trying to recreate a mammoth in all its woolly glory would require a ton of other genetic changes, so many that scientists don't have the technology to do it. And even if it was possible, Lynch thinks they shouldn't try it. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:18. Coming up, a bipartisan effort is underway to overhaul the federal criminal justice system.
We need to make sure that the punishment fits the crime and that we are scaling our resources appropriately towards the most serious offenders.
This cause has brought together an odd coalition of libertarians, evangelical conservatives, and liberals. More on that story coming up.
Support comes from the App Factory at UW Parkside. Is your business or nonprofit in need of a mobile app? Student interns at the App Factory make state-of-the-art and user-friendly apps for phones and other mobile devices. Web applications, too. For more information, visit appfactory.uwp.edu.
All. It's the best way to avoid mowing the lawn. For more information on our show schedule and tickets, click over to notmuch.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Officials in eastern Tennessee are preparing to allow thousands of residents back into their homes. They were evacuated after a CSX train carrying hazardous material derailed, catching fire. Maryville City Manager Greg McLean says officials are working on a plan to lift that evacuation.
We are ready to begin the process. It will be a process to develop plans for repopulation. Removing the evacuation in phases.
Some 5,000 residents were evacuated early yesterday. On this Independence Day holiday weekend in the U.S., law enforcement agencies around the country are ramping up security. The Department of Homeland Security and the FBI have warned Americans to be vigilant in case of a terror attack. Former FBI Special Agent Peter Ahern says recent terror attacks around the world should be a reminder that the nation cannot get complacent.
We need to keep people reminded and look at the historical events that are going on right now in the last 6 months to a year. Just kind of makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up a little bit more, and I think that's why you're seeing such a push here.
He says law enforcement has successfully prevented any big terror attacks in the U.S., but he says something could slip through. World financial markets, Asian markets closed in mixed territory by the bell. The Hang Seng in Hong Kong down nearly 1%, and U.S. markets are closed today in observance of the Independence Day holiday. This is NPR.
And this is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Noah Ovshinsky. After a five-week delay, the legislature's Budget Writing Committee has given final approval to a new two-year spending plan. The Joint Finance Committee early this morning voted 12-4 with all Republicans in support and all Democrats against the $70 billion budget. It now heads to the Senate and Assembly for debate. The budget touches the life of nearly every person in the state. Under the plan, funding for public schools would remain basically flat. The University of Wisconsin system would be cut by $250 million. In-state tuition would be frozen, and property taxes would remain basically flat. The Joint Finance Committee also voted to restore funding for maintenance and improvement projects at Wisconsin ports. Daniel Kading reports.
The Harbor Assistance Program received around $17 million in segregated fees and bonding in the last budget. That funding was almost completely stripped under the governor's budget. The program helps pay for public and private dock repairs, shipbuilding, and more. South Range Democrat Nick Milroy says the committee restored $13.2 million in bonding for harbor projects.
The Joint Finance Committee decided to fund the bonding authority for not only the Harbor Assistance Program, but also for some railway infrastructure by pulling back some bonding from the State Highway Program.
Milroy says the committee voted to cut back on the governor's recommended $43 million in bonding for freight rail to provide money for port improvement projects. Danielle Kading, Wisconsin Public Radio in Superior.
This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Jane and Michael Horvitz, supporting NPR and 90.3 WCPN IdeaStream in Cleveland, dedicated to building a more informed community together by producing in-depth journalism that informs, engages, and inspires. From Performance Bicycle, bikes and cycling gear for the entire family, store locations and an online store at performancebike.com. Performance Bicycle. Where great rides begin. From Organic Valley, a farmer-owned co-op committed to the craft of sustainable organic farming, makers of Organic Balance, a milk protein shake for women with 16 grams of protein. Learn more at organicvalley.coop. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. Nearly half the people who own a smartphone say they couldn't live without it, according to the Pew Research Center. As for the personal assistants inside the phone, not so much. Apple's Siri, or Google Now, can do a quick search or give a snarky answer to a question. But imagine having a phone that really gets you on a personal level. Turns out the two tech giants, Google and Apple, disagree on whether that's a worthy goal. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports.
Google is rolling out its new personal assistant tool, it's called Now on Tap, this fall. The company says it'll be as useful as Google Maps.
Maps has this like transformative power that like you never get lost.
Aparna Chennapragada is director of product.
That's kind of the power tool effect that imagine if you had a, you know, assistant on the phone that actually helped you not get lost in many other parts of life.
Let's take a simple, mundane example. You're playing a song in Spotify, the music app.
Okay, Google, what's their latest album?
Coldplay's latest album is A Head Full of Dreams.
Notice that Chennapragada didn't have to name the band. She just said their latest album. She didn't have to leave the app to go do a web search. She summoned the assistant with two words, okay, Google, and it replied in the moment. Let's take a slightly more complex example, planning a trip.
So the email says,
Chenna Pragada tells Google now to scan an email she got from her friend. It's about visiting the Grand Canyon.
Don't forget to pack sweaters. We found the temperature at night can get pretty low. Have fun.
The personal assistant creates a reminder in her calendar to pack sweaters, and it doesn't create a reminder to have fun. That's because it's getting better at understanding natural language, the way people talk to each other, not just to computers. The tool is also getting better at giving information we don't even know to ask for.
You're at Disneyland, for example, right? Turns out most people look for the popular rides and their wait times, right? Why should you have to look for that afresh? We should be able to like proactively tell you that.
Proactively tell you because it knows about Disneyland, about the other Google users at Disneyland, and about you. When you opt into the assistant, you're giving Google permission to analyze your activity in all Google products, search, Gmail, calendar, photos, everything. And you're letting Google look at your activity outside its products, like in the music app Spotify. Apple's approach is very different. Listen to Craig Federighi, Senior Vice President for Software Engineering, speaking at Apple's recent developer conference.
We don't mine your email, your photos, or your contacts in the cloud to learn things about you. We honestly just don't want to know.
Apple is working on a new tool to make Siri smarter. It's called Intelligence, and it will not be linked to a user's Apple ID. It's anonymous, more like a hotel concierge who helps you but doesn't know your name. Privacy fans like this decision, but technologists, like the guy who helped create Siri, say that makes for a less useful product.
Well, it's less compelling if it's anonymous because you have to describe in detail everything you want it to do rather than it applying those things on your behalf.
Doug Kitlaus isn't commenting on Apple specifically, but on how important personal data is for the next generation of personal assistants to work.
In your car and talking to your phone and your computer and maybe your refrigerator. It's so much easier if the system can identify that it's you talking and it can talk to you in a way that it knows you.
It might look like Apple and Google are drawing philosophical lines in the sand. But Horace DeDue, a tech analyst with Asimco, says it's really economic lines. Apple makes money by selling devices. That's why they don't value your data, financially speaking. But Google...
Google's business model, in contrast, is about selling the information about the user. So an advertiser will be given a better chance of getting the attention of the audience.
In the last few years, the smartphone has given Google a hard time. Yes, more than a billion people use the company's Android operating system, but revenue per user has gone down at times. People are listening to Coldplay on Spotify, not visiting a search page. DeDue says the personal assistant is Google's big move to reinsert itself. Arthi Shahani, NPR News, San Francisco.
Okay, this summer we at Morning Edition are doubling as travel agents. We're here to help plan your summer vacation, and we begin with advice from David Plotz. He's the CEO of Atlas Obscura. It is a website that lists little-known or hidden places that might be worth visiting. He tells us about two favorite spots, one that's easy to get to, another that requires a healthy sense of adventure.
I think we have this idea that exploration ended around 1900, that there was nothing left for the average person to find. But in fact, there is all around us magical spaces that we can have the sensation that we have found something new in the world. So our users love places of extraordinary beauty that is shocking, like Blood Falls in Antarctica, which is a waterfall that comes off of a glacier, and then there's this blood red running off of it because of the geological circumstances. And you see the pictures and think, holy moly, the world is strange and incredible. My favorite place in the Atlas is a place in Washington, D.C. It's called Fort DeRussy. You take a little path off of a main road, and all of a sudden, you see a dirt moat and then these earthen walls that rise 15 feet in the air, enclosing an area maybe the size of a basketball court. This is the remains of a Civil War fort. It's being completely swallowed by the forest. And you could stand on these parapets, on these fortifications, and imagine what it was like in 1864 when the Confederates attacked. And now it's this hidden place in the forest. And it's not that it's unknown. It's listed on the National Park Service website. But it's a place which is not fully visible. there's something about going to a place which has a history to it, and to imagine what it was like to have been a soldier at Fort DeRussy. You can almost feel other people's human experiences in the air around you. And so I think it's an act of profound empathy at a pretty deep level when you get a place which speaks to you.
That's David Plotz of the travel website Atlas Obscura speaking about two of his favorite obscure places to visit. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
In the age of streaming singles, our music team says the album still reigns supreme.
The album is definitely not dead, if only because it makes an absolute coherent statement. It's the quickest way to deeply understand where a musician is coming from.
From jazz to country to R&B, we tick through NPR's favorite albums of 2015 so far. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can catch All Things Considered right here on Wisconsin Public Radio at 3 o'clock.
Good morning, I'm Linda Wertheimer. The U.S. and Japan face off Sunday in the Women's World Cup final, but the match might already be decided. Olivia, a gray parrot at a Japanese zoo, has correctly predicted the past six games for Japan. Today she walked up to two flags, the Stars and Stripes and the Rising Sun. Olivia picked Japan. Now the U.S. team can demonstrate that sports analysts are purely bird-brained. It's Morning Edition.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, Republicans have talked about overhauling the party since President Obama's reelection, but after the Supreme Court rulings on Obamacare and same-sex marriage, plus the flap over the Confederate flag, is the GOP ready to move on and change? That story coming up.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from the Mead-Witter Foundation of Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin, supporting the activities of the citizens of central and northern Wisconsin, and encouraging your support of Wisconsin Public Radio programming.
Support comes from Music by the Lake at George Williams College of Aurora University in Williams Bay, featuring the John Pizzarelli Quartet, Sunday, July 12th at 4. The jazz guitarist singer has appeared with Frank Sinatra, Paul McCartney, and Natalie Cole. Tickets at musicbythelake.com.
Wisconsin classical musicians can always be counted on for a bit of the unexpected. And this Sunday, you can expect a scaled-down Haydn symphony, trio combinations from Henry Cowell, and dances from the Italian Renaissance. Enjoy musical surprises on Wisconsin Classical, Sunday at 1 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, mostly sunny in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy, scattered thunderstorms in northern Wisconsin in the afternoon. Otherwise, we'll have highs in the mid to upper 70s. Tonight, partly cloudy, patchy fog, and a chance of showers and storms in northern Wisconsin. Lows mainly in the 50s today. Tomorrow, Independence Day, partly cloudy. A slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. We're expecting highs in the 70s and 80s tomorrow. And Sunday, mostly clear, with highs in the lower to mid 80s. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, seeking to unlock the possibility inside every individual at gatesfoundation.org. From Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning, I'm David Green.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer. There are a lot of items on President Obama's wish list for his final months in office. Specifically, he says that he's
really interested in the possibilities, the prospect of bipartisan legislation around the criminal justice system.
The issue has brought together an unusual coalition, including the ACLU and Koch Industries. Now, advocates are demanding Congress and the White House translate rhetoric into action. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
People who've been trying to overhaul the federal criminal justice system say time is running out.
These next 5 weeks, I think, are really critical for us to see whether or not Washington is really ready to achieve meaningful reform to the federal sentencing and prison system.
Christine Leonard runs the Coalition for Public Safety. That's a strange bedfellows partnership of libertarians and evangelical conservatives who align with liberals on the need to
make sure that the punishment fits the crime and that we are scaling our resources appropriately towards the most serious offenders.
It's not just the cost of housing more than 200,000 people in federal prisons, about $7 billion this year, but aside from the financial price tag, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates says there's also public confidence to consider.
When the public doesn't believe that our criminal justice system is designed to punish and deter, but rather to warehouse and forget, that comes with a huge cost.
Singer John Legend put it this way at the Oscars ceremony this year.
The struggle for freedom and justice is real. We live in the most incarcerated country in the world.
5 years ago, law professor Michelle Alexander published a book she called The New Jim Crow. Here she is talking about it on the Colbert Report.
Well, today we have a new system of racial and social control, a system of mass incarceration that operates in ways that are eerily reminiscent of a system we supposedly left behind, thanks to the war on drugs and the Get Tough movement.
And that's where Congress and the White House come in. In Congress, bipartisan lawmakers introduced sprawling legislation to dial back on the Get Tough movement. Their bill would reserve prison space for violent criminals and career offenders. That's in the U.S. House. But advocates say they're paying more attention to the Senate. Negotiators there have been working quietly for weeks to reach a narrower deal, one that sources say would offer less risky inmates credits to get out of prison early. It may also put new limits on the number of people charged as drug leaders or kingpins, charges that carry long sentences. Not everyone is convinced about the need for change. A few longtime prosecutors say the current system is not broken, and they worry about a possible rise in crime if the wrong offenders get released. That's a point TV host Stephen Colbert made to the law professor Michelle Alexander.
It would be Mad Max cannibal culture in the street if you did that.
No.
That's chaos.
But the Justice Department says it's already been charging fewer drug defendants with crimes that carry long mandatory sentences for the past year. And since then, crime has not gone up, and those defendants are still pleading guilty at the same rates. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Republicans have been talking about reforming their party ever since President Obama was reelected. Now the Supreme Court has weighed in on two huge issues, Obamacare and same-sex marriage, and some see a moment of opportunity for the GOP to move on to fresh issues and create a new image. But as NPR national political correspondent Mara Liasson reports, change can be hard.
The Republican Party has a math problem, says GOP strategist Steve Schmidt.
Every single demographic group in the country that is growing, Democrats are growing their market share. Every single demographic group that is shrinking, Republicans are growing their market share. And that's a fundamental marketing problem.
And it's part of the reason why the GOP has lost the popular vote in the last 5 out of 6 presidential elections. But it's hard for Republicans to broaden their appeal to, say, young people or Hispanics when there's a big split inside the party on issues like gay marriage or immigration. And Republicans haven't even decided exactly how they need to change. Candidates like Ted Cruz argued that the party needs to return to its consistently conservative roots. And then there's the argument about tone versus substance.
Republicans have been arguing since 2012. Do we need to change the pizza or do we need to change the pizza box? And I think the correct answer is we need to change the pizza.
That's David Frum, who was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. He says it's not enough to change the tone with friendlier, less divisive rhetoric. Frum thinks Republican policies need to change, too. And that means accepting that Obamacare is not going away, same-sex marriage is now the law of the land, and that 11 million undocumented immigrants are here to stay. Frum says the party has made some progress.
On one cultural issue, the Confederate flag, we have seen emphatic and decisive change. On another cultural issue, same-sex marriage, we have seen slow evolution that has touched much of the party but isn't yet articulated by the leading presidential candidates.
As for improving the party's image with Hispanic voters, that task was made a lot harder this week by the candidate who is currently in second place in Iowa, New Hampshire, and national polls.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
Donald Trump, whose political persona is built around being outrageous, ended up reinforcing the most negative perceptions of Republicans. There was a huge backlash as companies like Univision and Macy's rushed to cut ties with Trump. But only a few of the other Republican presidential candidates criticized him. Jeb Bush did answer a question asked in Spanish about Trump's remarks after a town hall meeting in Nevada. Bush says in translation, "I disagree with his remarks. They do not represent the values of the Republican Party, and they do not represent my values." Maybe not a huge profile in courage, but, says Steve Schmidt, there's a reason no major Republican candidate has made a point of taking on Trump.
There's an old saying about wrestling with a pig. Both of you get dirty and the pig likes it, and there's something of that going on.
And it's hard to get the Republican Party in sync with the majority of voters on immigration reform, same-sex marriage, or climate change when the Republican primary electorate is headed in the opposite direction. Democrats, watching from the wings, are barely able to contain their glee at the GOP's difficulties. Here's Hillary Clinton at a rally in Virginia last week.
A lot of Republicans may talk about having new ideas and fresh faces, but across the board, they're the party of the past, not the future.
It's still very early. Republicans have time to show voters they are a modern, future-oriented party. But if the image of Republicans as anti-immigrant, anti-gay, and anti-science sticks, it will be a problem for the GOP next year. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
And it's Morning Edition from NPR News.
And you're listening to Morning Edition on Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8:41. Coming up in 10 minutes on the Marketplace Morning Report, the latest in the Greek debt negotiations saga. That plus all the morning's business news coming up in 10 minutes. In the weather forecast for today, we're looking at mostly sunny skies in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy. Otherwise, we'll have scattered thunderstorms in northern Wisconsin in the afternoon and highs in the mid to upper 70s.
So we're on the highway speeding southward out of Tehran.
From the deserts of Iran to the plains of North Dakota.
This is a classic Main Street. I'm standing on Dakota Avenue.
Every day, Morning Edition takes you to the news.
We went to this rally in the southern city of Kandahar for candidate Abdullah.
Come along for the journey. Start the week with Morning Edition from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Malaysia's prime minister is dismissing allegations that a state investment firm deposited nearly $700 million in his personal bank accounts. NPR's Anthony Kuhn tells us government investigators are examining alleged abuses by the fund.
Najib has survived a few allegations of impropriety before. The most lurid of these may be reports linking him to a Mongolian model. Two of Najib's bodyguards were convicted of murdering the woman in 2006 and then getting rid of her body by blowing it up with plastic explosives.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn. Spain's prime minister is touting his country's economic recovery in stark contrast to Greece. Lauren Freyer reports from Madrid. Spanish politicians are using Greece as an example of the worst-case scenario they managed to avoid.
Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy says the Spanish economy is so robust he's able to slash income taxes. He forecasts 3.3% growth this year, twice as fast as the Eurozone average. All this is fueling speculation he could call early elections. He hopes to halt the surge of an anti-austerity party here by pointing to what's happened in Greece under a left-wing government.
Lauren Freyer in Madrid. A solar-powered airplane is set to land in Hawaii today after a five-day journey over the Pacific Ocean. The flight from Japan was the longest leg of the around-the-world voyage by two Swiss pilots. This is NPR News.
And this is news from Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Noah Ovshinsky. Governor Scott Walker's budget proposal cleared its first major hurdle last night, passing the legislature's Joint Finance Committee on a party-line vote. Sean Johnson reports.
While issues like transportation spending and restricting open records were front and center in the Finance Committee yesterday, lawmakers focused most of their closing remarks on the budget votes they took more than a month ago. Republican Assembly Co-Chair John Nygren said the budget was good for the people who fund state government.
The taxpayers. There's no new taxes. There's no tax increases.
But Madison Democrat Chris Taylor said Republicans ignored their constituents' pleas to adequately fund public schools and reverse a massive cut to the UW.
It seems like
you all really just followed this governor off a cliff, and he lands in another state every day, but you're still here.
The budget could still undergo changes in the full legislature next week. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin whistleblower Ryan Honnell has asked President Barack Obama to go outside the Department of Veterans Affairs to appoint a chief watchdog for the agency. Honnell met Obama yesterday at the airport ahead of Obama's speech at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Honnell brought attention to overprescribing practices and retaliatory behavior at a VA medical center in Toma. The hospital is at the center of multiple investigations after reports concluded patients there were given high doses of narcotics. This is WPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Progressive Insurance with its Apron Project, celebrating progress and the people who make it happen. From the Jack Kent Cook Foundation, providing scholarships throughout the nation to exceptionally high-performing students with financial need, from middle school to college. More information about Cook scholarships is available at jkcf.org. And from Cigna, a global health service company dedicated to helping people improve their health, well-being, and sense of security at Cigna.com.
It's time for Wisconsin Life. You can learn a lot about human nature from how we play games. June Melby shares what she learned watching people play mini golf at her family's course in Waupaca.
You can learn a lot about people by how they play games. I'm not the first person to say so, but I've probably spent more time testing the idea than most. When I was 10 years old, my parents bought a miniature golf course in Wisconsin. We lived in a cottage behind the 18th hole every summer, Labor Day through Memorial Day. We didn't take another summer vacation after that, but I'm not bitter. Sure, I might have enjoyed going to camp or a trip to Disneyland, but instead, I spent my summers in a ticket booth, 7 days a week. Working, which is to say, watching people play. The first thing you learn is that people laugh the loudest when things go wrong. Success is never as hilarious as failure. All day long, you'd hear people yell out, "Oh no!" followed by a scream and then laughter. The most difficult holes were everyone's favorite. No one wants their mini golf game to be too easy. It might not surprise you to hear that people cheat. But it might come as a surprise that sometimes parents teach their children how to cheat. You could win a free game on the last hole. There was a clown face, and if you got your ball in the nose, then a bell would ring, and we'd hand you a free game card. We loved giving out free games. The bell was loud, and everyone smiled. It was festive. I remember one time I was working, and an ordinary-looking family came to the last hole. The parents ducked down like commandos, crept up the fairway, and then waved their children to follow. There was a wire screen in front of the clown face, and the father knelt there, wedging his fingers underneath it. "Shh, shh," he said, tossing his ball under it towards the nose. The mother wedged her fingers under, and then the kids, aiming for the nose. When their last ball actually fell into the nose, they were surprised as I was. The family looked up expectantly. There was no bell. All was quiet. "But it went in," said the boy. I was alone in the ticket booth at the time. The family didn't realize I had seen them. They didn't know the bell wasn't automatic anymore. My father had disconnected it because he didn't like ringing the lovely bell for people who didn't deserve it. So I waited. When they came to turn in their putters, would the family ask for a free game? It was perhaps the most exciting moment of the summer. I was only 12, but I understood I was about to witness human nature. What kind of people were these? Who teaches their children how to cheat? Sheepishly, the parents avoided my eyes. No one spoke. The children looked at me strangely when finally the youngest boy burst out, "Hey, I think we got it in the nose." "Yes, I know," I said. "I was watching." And then I added in a voice used by high school principals all around the world, "I'm sorry." The parents pretended not to hear me, and together with their children, sulked their way across the parking lot. I looked out onto the mini golf course where the blades of the windmill still turned. I knew I was more grown up than I had been just 1 hour before.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our new website at wisconsinlife.org. The music gets started with the Blue Danube Waltz right after 9 o'clock, and the playlist also includes Variations on Yankee Doodle and a couple of new releases. Join Stephanie Elkins for Morning Classics in 10 minutes right after the Marketplace Morning Report here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Supporting WGTD is the Bristol Renaissance Fair, featuring an open-air marketplace, food, drink, and nonstop entertainment, all in the style and pageantry of 16th century England. Online at renfair.com. Open weekends through Labor Day.
Through expressive art therapy, Wisconsin Public Radio is pleased to support activities that support wounded veterans. For more information, visit wpr.org/events.
Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, mostly sunny in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy. We're expecting scattered thunderstorms in northern Wisconsin, otherwise highs in the mid to upper 70s. Tonight, partly cloudy, patchy fog, and a chance of showers and storms in northern Wisconsin. We'll have lows mainly in the mid to upper 50s today. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a service of the Wisconsin Educational Communications Board and the University of Wisconsin Extension, with additional financial support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from listeners through the Wisconsin Public Radio Association.
Support comes from Grady Design Harborside Eye Care, now featuring private label frames that can be customized by size and color to your liking, specializing in thorough eye exams and superior one-on-one service. For an eye exam or frame viewing appointment, Grady Design Harborside Eye Care, 262-652-2020.
The amazing shrinking Shanghai stock market tumbles today.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. The key measure of the stock market in Shanghai fell 5.4% today. Now, in the last year, that CSI index is still up 82%, but there's been what market players call a correction of late. BBC Business reporter Andrew Wood is watching this from Hong Kong. Morning to you.
Good morning.
If you look at stock prices over the last year and only look through, oh, I don't know, about the middle of last month, June, there was a spectacular rise, but it's evaporating, it seems.
From June last year to the middle of June this year, the Shanghai stock market, depending on which index you look at, more than doubled in value. And over the past 2 or 3 weeks since the middle of June, it's lost 25 to 30% of its value. I mean, shares were even down 7% on Friday morning in trading, although they did recover a little bit by the time the market closed.
A lot of reasons for this. Some of it is just a correction, many people are telling me. However, there's a bit of a catalyst today for today's decline.
Well, yes, there have been jitters about Greece have affected all market in East Asia, so that didn't help. But here we've had an announcement, or rather from Beijing, there's the announcement through the state news agency of an investigation of manipulation. The securities regulator is going to be looking into that. They're looking in particular about mis-selling of financial products, and there are accusations of short selling, of foreigners selling shares that they don't have in order to drive the price down, and that becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, so they make even more money by selling short, and so the price goes down even further.
And it's worth pointing out, the Shanghai market is a peculiar creature.
Well, Chinese stocks are usually quite volatile. Shanghai is a very unusual market. There's a lot of money in the mainland of China chasing very low rates of returns in banks. So people put a lot of money into the stock market. And the stock market sometimes is more like a really a speculative thing rather than reflecting the fundamentals or the outlook for business and so on. So to a certain extent, there's been that. Also, people have been borrowing money, margin trading, in order to speculate on the stock market. That's being unwound now. The regulators are cutting down on that. So a lot of people are facing big losses, and that tends to magnify the downward movements.
BBC business reporter Andrew Wood in Hong Kong. Andrew, thank you.
Thanks.
Let's check some other numbers. The Hang Seng Index, which favors Hong Kong over Shanghai listed shares, was down just 0.8% compared to that 5.4% fall on the mainland. The 100-share index in London currently down 0.7%. The DAX index is down 0.4%. Wall Street is off ahead of the 4th of July. Greece. Polls suggest the public is split over whether they will vote yes or no on Sunday in the snap referendum on whether to accept conditions of a financial rescue package. Banks there are closed, but petty cash is available using cards, and credit cards often work. The International Monetary Fund has now issued a surprising prescription acknowledging that creditors need to let Greece restructure its debt, a heretofore taboo subject. In the U.S., there's news today that the Aetna Insurance Company is buying rival Humana for $34 billion in cash and stock. Humana is especially strong in the area of private Medicare insurance. That is to say, they manage Medicare patients, then bill the government. Anthem and Cigna are talking about a merger again, according to the Wall Street Journal, this after Cigna rejected an offer last month. The biggie in all of this is United Healthcare, and it might also pick a merger target, although some analysts say United Health is strong enough on its own.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Zillow. With millions of homes for sale, apartments for rent, photos, historical pricing data, and other resources. Available on Zillow.com or on their mobile and tablet apps. Zillow, find your way home.
As part of this holiday weekend, many of us will buck up our courage and bravely face the crowds at a theme park. Around the country, parks are adding new attractions and some scarier roller coaster rides to grab our attention and perhaps our cash, Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
It's LA, so of course a new theme park ride gets the red carpet treatment, literally.
Party, welcome to Fast and Furious Supercharged!
When Universal Studios Hollywood opened its new summer ride in June, there were stunt drivers, fireworks, and enough red, orange, gold, and black confetti to keep a cleaning crew busy for hours. But a successful ride takes more than a flashy premiere. Chick Russell is the executive producer of Fast and Furious Supercharged, whose job at Universal is to take a hit movie franchise and turn it into a hit ride.
When we begin a new ride design, we sit down and we figure out what can we do that takes the film experience to a whole new level on a thrill ride.
The new ride is part of the studio tour through the Universal lot. All of a sudden, there's an unexplained muscle car. The FBI and the Fast and Furious crew get involved, and courtesy of some theme park magic, riders feel like they're rocketing down the highway, getting shot at by drones, jumping over a bridge, crashing into a warehouse. Whew. Universal won't say what the ride cost, but new theme park attractions can run tens of millions of dollars.
Well, we always say the first commandment of the theme park industry is thou must reinvest.
John Robinette's VP of Economics at AECOM, which researches the theme park industry. He says park attendance has been growing since the end of the recession, up about 2% last year. The biggies like Disney and Universal have been doing even better. AECOM estimates Universal Studios Hollywood saw an 11% jump in 2014.
Investing in family-friendly rides and shows and with broad appeal is the highest correlation with attendance.
A good ride needs to do more than get people in the park. It needs to get their friends there, too. The tram operator at Universal reminded riders to spread the word.
Share your experience.
New rides mean new riders mean more ticket sales and more reminders of the Fast and Furious franchise. All good for Universal's bottom line. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
After France's interior minister said the other day the car service Uber was operating illegally, Uber's French representatives were defiant, saying the demand for its service continues and it'll keep it in service. But today, there's word Uber will suspend one of its key offerings in France. Uber Pop, which uses the non-professional drivers, will stop pending a court decision in September about the constitutionality of a new law that prohibits parts of Uber. Taxi drivers in France pay about $100,000 for a special license, something Uber Pop drivers often don't have. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
And this is WPR, where there's news for you Saturday and Sunday as well, with Weekend Edition and Weekend All Things Considered both days, whether over the air, on demand with the free WPR app, or online at WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Wisconsin Maritime Museum, presenting SubFest July 10th through the 12th in downtown Manitowoc, a maritime festival offering submarine tours, classic movies, and exhibits. WisconsinMaritime.org.
Support for WGTD comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Andrea's, a proud supporter of programming on WGTD HD.
You're listening to WGTD HD.